Today on Vox Talks Economics, the economic consequences of the war in Ukraine. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Instagram. Well, this summer, Vox Talks is bringing you interviews recorded at CPR's Paris Symposium. And on everyone's minds at this conference, of course, the war in Ukraine and its impact on Europe's economy. Montesquieu once wrote that the natural effect of trade is to bring about peace. And of course, that's also the principle that drove the foundation of the EU. Philippe Martin of Sciences Po and CPR, he's studied the links between war and trade over many years. And Lucrezia Reichlin of the London Business School, expert on the structure of Europe and its policies. And they join me now. So welcome, Philippe.
Nice to see you.
And Lucrezia.
Nice to be here.
Philippe, we do tend to assume that global trade is going to bring global peace. The research that you've done over the years, that shows that is not really true, is it?
Well, it's an old question, but indeed, it's not as straightforward as you've just put it, in the sense that indeed, what we were showing both theoretically and empirically is that if I trade more with you, yes, it's going to increase the probability that we don't go into conflict, simply because if we were to go to war, we would destroy this trade and this would have an economic opportunity cost. So that's true. And that's actually verified empirically, that when bilaterally countries trade more, they have less probability of going to war. But if now I trade more with Lucrezia and others, then in this case, I reduce my dependence on you. And therefore, I have less of an opportunity cost to go to war with you. And what we were showing is that indeed, multilateral trade, which is obviously one dimension of globalization, is increasing the probability, especially of local small conflicts. Countries which are close to each other, which have reasons for conflicts, ethnic problems, borders, etc., etc. If they trade more with the rest of the world, they trade less bilaterally, or at least their bilateral dependence goes down, and that increases the probability of war. So as you see, trade can go both ways.
And the situation that we're seeing now, Russia and Europe in opposition, not at war, but in opposition, and therefore there will be trade problem that arises from that.
Yeah, trade is actually playing a big role in this war, in the sense that there are trade sanctions. Trade has been destroyed in the sense that exports from Europe, from the rest of the world to Russia has gone down quite a lot. In fact, more or less by the average that we found in the post-World War II when there's a conflict. And in a sense, if you think about the trade dependence that some European countries have towards Russia, like Germany, why is it that we are not more aggressive with Russia? Why are we not putting more trade restrictions, etc.? It's because we have this bilateral dependence vis-à-vis Russia. So the argument that says that trade is pacifying is true again, but here pacification means being less aggressive for Europe towards Russia. So it's not always positive. So at least the Ukrainians would say it's not a very good consequence of these trade relations or strong trade dependence that we Europeans have had with Russia, which, and some say, have been actually built by Russia in the perspective of this war to increase the trade dependence of European countries vis-à-vis Russia.
Lucrezia, it's undeniable that what's happened in the last few months in this conflict has changed a lot of the thinking in Europe about how it organizes its economy, its the self-sufficiency of Europe.
What is really being discussed is what kind of energy policy will Europe have from now on. So I think there is not just an impact in the short run, because of course the increase in energy prices, it's a big shock on the real disposable income, negative shock on the real disposable income, which poses the questions how to deal with that using stabilization tools, monetary fiscal policy. But there is also the medium long-term questions of how do we make sure that Europe will become more self-sufficient from Russia and without getting in the hands of another unreliable trade partners from, you know, North Africa and the Middle East. It's not that we are going from one terrible country to fantastic potential trade partners. So the question is, what is the strategy in the long term? And then how does this relate to the ambitious Green Deal that was the main think for Europe until yesterday. And this means that we have a careful calibration of national and policy at the federal levels, both for crisis management, but also in terms of reorient our strategy. And there are basically two points. One, how to ensure that Europe can rely on cheap energy, and also how to move to clean energy as fast as possible. The two objectives are not necessarily compatible with one another, at least in the short term. What we have seen so far in the European response, in my view, is quite underwhelming in many ways. Okay, so national policies have been going on their own way, and they have been not necessarily coherent with what Europe as a whole trying to achieve. And the instrument that Europe has put on the table, the common instruments, like, for example, the Repower EU program, is really underwhelming because there is basically no fresh resources, except for 20 billion, which are going to be taken from the auction of the ETS. So this is actually dirty money. It's not clean money. And it's not very much, because just on the stabilization part, on what we need to do to compensate the group of the population which are hit harder by the shock, I mean, we are talking about something like maybe 0.7% of GDP. I mean, these are the numbers that the European Commission has suggested. So how to deal that with a fragmented market, without common stabilization tools, and without the governance to deal with also other issues like stocking and using the kind of common capacity, all this is really not there, at least not yet.
Well, let's try and solve some of those policy problems by the end of the podcast. Philippe, as we record this, we have seen a very difficult negotiation between the countries in Europe about getting an oil embargo across the line. Is the problem here mainly economic, or is it political, and therefore economic solutions really won't get these sort of sanctions done?
Well, the issue is the political consequences of the economic impact of these trade sanctions. So indeed, there are several instruments, embargo, tariff, or a price cap. And in relation to what Ruklesa was saying, as economists, I guess we would go for a tariff because it's more efficient and it's more consistent also with the long-term goals that we have for transition. But a tariff is a very difficult thing to sell to politicians, because right now, when the price of energy is super high, telling them that we're going to put a tax on oil or on gas is going to be very difficult, even though we try to explain them that you know, the incidence partly is going to be on the Russians, that the Russians would have to absorb part of the tariff, something like maybe 30% discount, still it's super difficult. And clearly, the discussion is moving, maybe in the right direction, but super slowly. And one problem is that today, markets do expect that at some point, some of these trade sanctions are going on energy, are going to bite, are going to be decided. But in the meantime, what's happening is that if you expect oil to be super expensive in 3, 4, 5 months because of sanctions, the price of oil is increasing right now, which is bad for us and very good for Mr. Putin. So I think we have a bit of indecision, which I understand where it comes from, is really a bad situation to be in.
Lucrezia, we also have the problem that any sanctions fall unequally on the different members of the European Union. Is there any mechanism that we can put in place to share the load more evenly?
Well, it's not only that there will be differential impacts on countries, but also within the countries across different groups of population. We know that for the more fragile groups of population, the impact on real income could be the double that what we have on average. So this poses the double questions of, you know, how do we kind of design a stabilization policies that is coherent with the overall objective that we want to achieve. Now, Philippe and I have written extensively on the need for Europe to get a common fiscal yes. capacity. Yeah. And I think the case for a common fiscal capacity at this juncture is even stronger than during COVID. So this is why there was a hope that this fiscal effort that we have, that overall we had put together, could be financed by common debt with a kind of another temporary instruments like the one that was implemented during COVID. This is clearly not what is going to happen, at least not for now. So the situation has to have to become really worse before the EU politicians will decide to go there. So the money that has been put on the table, as I was saying before, is all basically recycling of the old NGO programs, mostly, except for the 20 billion ETS.
It does produce this pull towards a common European energy policy, some common European fiscal policy. How long do you think before that is feasible at all, no matter what the economic argument is for it?
Look, with the COVID crisis, we made enormous progress. Huh? So mm-hmm. it looks as if we do progress through crisis. And coming back to what Lucrecia was saying, the problem with the Ukraine crisis is that it doesn't fit the story that when there's a crisis, we integrate more, at least from an economic point of view. There's some integration clearly on the political side, even potentially on military side. But it's very strange that this, the idea of having a common debt to finance our effort to help Ukraine or help countries which are hit indirectly by Ukraine does not work. And that's a bit of a problem because if we're going to go towards a more integrated military alliance or cooperation or energy, but not on the fiscal side, it's difficult to see how this can be consistent.
Yes, Lucrezia, like you said, it means that there are some difficult decisions ahead about where Europe gets its energy from, aren't there?
Yeah, I think to me, this is like problem number one. There is a lot of historical evidence that the Industrial Revolution took place in the UK because of the cheap coal and the location of the coal sources near urban centers. And this is why the Industrial Revolution happened in the UK, not in China. Mm-hmm. So now if you look at the energy situations in Europe now, you can just extrapolate clearly that we are going to be at a very big disadvantage in terms of our competitiveness in the world market if we don't solve this problem.
You also mentioned that this really does drive a truck through the whole green energy argument for Europe.
Right. As usual, it's a problem of discount rate. What is the horizon? In a way, if we look in 200 years from now, maybe this discussion doesn't matter, right? Because if we don't deal with the CO2 emissions, there will not be a world where we can compete with trade. So Europe was very, in a way, visionary and ambitious in putting together the Green Deal. But now looking with quite an alarm, the fact that a lot of the provisions of the Green Deal have been relaxed because of the emergency. While I think that this is maybe the occasion, could be the occasion to accelerate the green transition rather than slowing it down.
Clearly, the consequences of the war are most severe for the people who are directly affected, but there will be consequences of this war long run for the European Union. Give me your opinion. Do you think those consequences will help the Union pull tighter together, or will it tend to fracture it?
I would guess that in the short term, it's going to fracture it because we don't find an agreement on these trade sanctions. Mm-hmm. In the long term, I still think that through the political and military and defense implications, we will have to have some common financial fiscal instruments if we want to go in that direction.
Lucrezia?
I think we will have to go towards the direction of more unity. It's existential. We will get there one way or another, but the problem is essentially political. And I'm an economist, but I don't want to talk as an economist because I recognize that to have a common energy policy, a common fiscal policy, without having the political democratic accountability to take decision, would make the European Union an authoritarian state. So that we need to accelerate on the political round as well.
I'm not sure that we did solve all the problems by the end of the podcast, but at least we managed to talk about them. Lucrezia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Philippe as well.
Thank you.
This has been a Vox Talk recorded live at CPR Paris Symposium 2022. Every week, we bring you the most important latest research, so subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And when you subscribe, you'll find more than 200 episodes. So whatever type of economics you like, there is a Vox Talk waiting for you.